Hi, I'm Annie Leonard with The Story of Stuff. Welcome to another episode of The Good Stuff, where we talk with people who are working on solutions to the take, make, waste system that's trashing the planet, threatening our communities, and harming our health. Do you read the ingredient labels on products in the store? Nowadays, most of us want to know what chemicals are in the products we put on our bodies or use in our homes. But without a degree in organic chemistry, how are we supposed to make sense of the labels? Sometimes all of the ingredients aren't even listed, or they're hidden behind words like fragrance. Here's a popular baby shampoo: propylparaben, quaternium 15, sorbitan laurate, tocopherol acetate. I can hardly even say these names. Sure, we can look these products up on websites like Good Guide or Skin Deep, but why should we have to do all this work? I don't know about you, but I hated chemistry in school. Wouldn't it make more sense if we knew that all the products on the shelf had been tested and found safe? My guest today is one of the many people working on that. She works closely with both governments and businesses to promote the exciting and rapidly advancing field of green chemistry. That means coming up with new ways to make chemicals and the products made with them safer. Most of our environmental laws try to regulate toxic pollution to some predetermined acceptable level or clean it up after it happens. But the real issue is not how much poison the government or industry says is safe for us to be exposed to, but our right not to be exposed at all. Green chemistry turns that around by working to reduce chemical pollution at its source before products ever reach the marketplace. Green chemistry has the potential to totally transform the relationship between ourselves and the stuff that we use in our everyday lives. Listen into our conversation and learn more about the hidden poisons in everyday products and what's being done to keep us safer. But I promise, no chemistry tests. So let's go. Recently, I sat down to talk with someone whose work has inspired me for a long time. For more than 25 years, Beverly Thorpe has campaigned for safer products with the United Nations, Greenpeace International, and other organizations. Today, she's co-director of Clean Production Action, whose mission is to turn the vision of clean production into practical tools to advance greener chemicals, sustainable materials, and safer products. Clean Production Action works through both advocacy, public campaigns for chemical reform, and collaboration, working directly with manufacturers to help them make green chemistry part of the way they do business. She has taught me so much over the years. And I'm proud to say she's also a board member of the Story of Stuff project. Welcome, Bev.
Sure.
What is clean production?
Clean production is a way of thinking how materials and products are made. And clean production is basically a way that you make materials in a sustainable way with non-toxic inputs. The product itself is non-toxic, which means it can be recycled and reused safely.
When you say materials, you're not talking about fabric, like a material store. What are you talking about?
No, that's true. I know people don't. When you talk about materials, it's probably better to talk about how stuff is made. So from the beginning of the extraction or how it's grown, how it's then manufactured into a product, how the product is used, and then what happens to the product after it's finished with. Do you discard it? Do you recycle it? What actually happens to it? And unless you have clean production principles or you think about things sustainably, you're going to have increasingly toxic materials that go into bad disposal. Plus, of course, it just increases the use and consumption of resources. So green chemistry is the opposite of toxic chemistry. So is this chemical, once it's in a product, is it going to cause cancer? Is it going to persist in the environment? Is it going to become a water pollutant? By designing chemistry right from the get-go with these principles in mind, you can actually make materials the way that nature intends.
So one of the many things I love about talking with you, Bev, is that you really encourage me and others to think upstream, to think about the production. Now, often when we think about the problems with our stuff, we think about it as garbage, like we're making too much stuff. What are we going to do with all this stuff when it's done? Do we burn it? Do we bury it? Do we compost it? What do we do with this? We all know
throwing plastic away is a problem. It fills our garbage cans. It's hard to recycle. It makes its way into the ocean. It clogs up sea turtles. It's a huge problem with the disposal. But can you tell me a little about the production of plastic? Where does it come from? What happens before we get it? Just today, when you walked into the studio here of Youth Radio, you picked up a big red, looked like a rubber ball that was in the studio. You picked it up and immediately you started looking for that little chasing arrow sign that tells you what polymer or what type of plastic it is. And you saw that it was the number 3. So what did you think?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't think, you know, I tend to be a bit of a chemical detective. I like to see how much information a consumer or a member of the public is getting when you look at products. And let's face it, we don't really get much information about the kinds of materials and products and chemicals, the kind of chemicals that are in products. But with many plastics, you can find little arrows sometimes. If you pick up, you know, when we were in the diner just now, I picked up a plastic, I think it was a ketchup bottle or something, and turned it over and found it had a 4 on it, low-density polyethylene. Now, to most people, this means nothing. And usually it's there for the recycling industry to understand what they're recycling. But I always look for 3s because that means 3 means vinyl, PVC, polyvinyl chloride. And because it's such a toxic plastic in its manufacturing, I know in my mind I have a picture of how that plastic inflatable ball was made.
How is PVC made?
PVC begins when you take basic oil and you mix it with chlorine. That's why it's called polyvinyl chloride, PVC. The C is the chlorine part of it. And it goes through various stages until involving a lot of known carcinogens and chemicals that are known to cause cancer. It then becomes sort of pellets or some kind of material which is then taken as PVC. And because PVC on its own is fairly useless, it needs tons and tons of different additives and stabilizers and all sorts of other chemicals that go into mixing it. For instance, to make PVC soft, as in the cords in your electronic components or in soft PVC toys, it needs tons and tons of chemicals called phthalates. And the reason I'm using this term is because there's a lot of restrictions right now on the use of these chemicals because they're known to be very toxic, particularly to children. So it's sort of, we used to think of it as a sink for all sorts of bad chemistry. And unfortunately, it's very cheap. And what's increasingly worrying for me is that there's a massive expansion of PVC production globally, particularly in China, Southeast Asia, Latin America. So we're exporting this kind of very toxic production of a very toxic plastic globally.
Why are we expanding the production of a plastic that is so hazardous to our health?
I don't think many people understand the difference between different types of plastics. I think generally the average consumer probably thinks plastic is plastic. Because why would you necessarily know the difference between polycarbonate and polystyrene and polyethylene? So, you know, plastics generally to the average person is just plastic. Sometimes it might smell bad. You know, if you buy a vinyl shower curtain and you hang it up, you say, oh, what is that smell? That's these phthalates that are off gassing off the plastic. But on the whole, unless you're in industry or you're a product designer and you have to choose the different types of plastics, I don't think most people really understand the dangers of it. There are some restrictions right now on vinyl PVC toys, particularly for children under 3. The European Union, quite a few years ago, set in regulations against the use of phthalates, these softeners in vinyl. So, of course, what the vinyl industry has done is found replacements for phthalates. And I remember once going into a drugstore and I saw a PVC children's book, you know, the kind that you use in the bathtub, and it said non-toxic. And I thought, oh, that's so clever. They've taken out the phthalate that was under regulation, but it's still a vinyl. It's still a vinyl book for kids. Well, of course, how would anyone know what's toxic, what's not toxic? And this comes back down to this whole issue about, you know, are we supposed to be chemical detectives now? Is each one of us supposed to be learning about the difference between plastics? I mean, who would have known that the inflatable ball here in the recording studio had a very toxic life cycle? So that's why we find that working with companies to actually phase out the uses of these plastics sort of gets ahead of the game. I think it's more efficient. And you're actually seeing a lot of companies now avoiding plastics. Avoiding PVC plastic.
Clearly, PVC is one of the more problematic plastics, both because of its actual toxicity and all these additives that are added in. How is one supposed to recognize PVC? Like, I don't want PVC in my house. How can I find it? You mentioned the chasing arrows with the number 3, and the number 3 stands for PVC. So I can look at items and see if it has that little triangle made out of chasing arrows and the number 3, but a lot of the plastics aren't labeled. So what is a super busy mom to do?
Well, again, it's hard because, and I think this is a fundamental problem with the products we bring into our homes, is that where do you find the information about the chemistry of that product? It's not easy. And I'm not trying to back out and try to avoid the question. It's really not easy. I'll give you an example. Back in 2005, we worked with a bunch of groups around the U.S. to collect vacuum bag dust. We had about 100 homes. We asked people to vacuum their homes, just normal homes. We collected the vacuum bags, sent them to a lab, and we ran them through the lab to identify what kind of hazardous chemicals were in household dust. And it was unbelievable to me. We expected to find hazardous materials, but for instance, every one of the samples, we found DDT. DDT is a pesticide that was banned. You know, Rachel Carson highlighted the problems of DDT back in the 1960s. And this is a very hazardous pesticide that was subsequently banned. But one of the reasons why it was banned was because it was persistent, which means it lasts in the environment for decades and decades and decades. So here we were in 2005 finding this pesticide in vacuum bag dust. And then the question was, well, how did it get into my home? Well, it got into my home probably by just tracking dust and dirt into your home on your shoes. Well, how did it get outside? It was simply there from when DDT was sprayed, you know, ubiquitously around the U.S. So the reason why I find chemistry and chemicals fascinating is that these things can last for decades and decades. And at the same time, they can be causing direct human health and environmental impacts.
And presumably some of the hazardous chemicals in that dust was coming from products we just bought last week.
Yes. We found, for instance, that, again, this word phthalates, we found they were present in all the vacuum dust. And we also found all sorts of other chemicals which are associated with plastics, one of which, for instance, you sometimes hear the term flame retardant chemicals. These are chemicals that are put into plastics. Because when you think about it, plastic's made of oil, so, you know, you don't want something that made of oil is not going to be flame retardant. Unfortunately, to make these plastics flame retardant, we use a lot of toxic chemistry. We don't have to be doing. We could be going down the green chemistry path. But usually they're there, they're available, they work, there's no regulations to stop anyone doing it. And so you do have these, we found in household dust, flame retardant chemicals that probably came off all the computer equipment in people's homes.
So what is one to do? We obviously don't want to rid our houses of electronics and furniture and toys and other appliances that release this stuff. What are we supposed to do then? How do we keep our families safe?
Well, again, this comes back down to the responsibility of the companies who are making the products. And a lot of people say to me, who should, you know, what product should I be buying, or what store should I shop at, or which retailer is doing the best to get rid of these hazardous chemicals? And it's a two-part situation. And I know folks that understand that change needs to come from all sorts of different parts of our society. But certainly businesses have a huge responsibility. I mean, anyone making a product should, first of all, know everything about the chemicals that are going into their product. If you're making a product, you should know through your supply chain every chemical that's being used in your product. So if you are manufacturing electronic equipment, you should ask your polymer or your plastic suppliers a full range, a full audit in some ways of all the chemicals that are used in that plastic. And some of the company leaders are actually now phasing out the most toxic chemicals and causing plastic producers to actually reformulate to get rid of chemicals that are known to cause cancer, that are known to cause reproductive diseases in children. So I, in some ways, I'm very hopeful that reformulation and innovation to safer chemistry can happen because we've seen it already with some companies.
And what inspires these companies that do come to you and say, we want to do better? What's behind their inspiration?
The people that come to the table are those that are really keen to understand the tools and strategies that they can use to better understand the chemicals in their products and work to find safer alternatives. I'll give you an example. We have a tool called the Green Screen for Safer Chemicals, and it's a way that you can plug in all the chemicals that you use in your products. For instance, in polymers, the chemicals in plastics, you can actually run them through the green screen and see which ones are hazardous and which ones are safer. And companies like Hewlett-Packard are using green screen to dialogue with their plastic suppliers to say, you need to get out of chemicals that are known to cause cancer, endocrine-disrupting chemicals, hormone-disrupting chemicals, chemicals that are going to cause reproductive problems in children. We want you to get out of that whole range of hazardous chemicals. And in some cases, it's the first time these plastic producers have ever been asked this question. And they don't really know necessarily the chemicals in their own plastics. It's made them reassess the chemistry in their own polymers. And in some cases, we've actually seen the plastic suppliers completely reformulate to get these chemicals out.
You've really expanded my thinking. When I used to think about plastics, I thought the problem was disposal. But if plastic is not only choking sea turtles and making all these toxic fumes in garbage incinerators, it's also poisoning all these workers and communities before it even turns into the product, what are we to do? What's the solution?
We find that within a lot of companies, there are individual champions that are driven either by, as one person said to me, the reason I do this work is for my grandchildren. And, you know, it sounds like a sort of a soppy thing to do, but I've actually visited him in his company, and sure enough, his grandkids are tacked up on the bulletin board next to his worksheet. And you have, you know, you just have some really good, thoughtful, value-based people that are working in these companies that just get the okay from their CEO to move forward on this. But let's be honest, it's also a brilliant way of avoiding business risks down the road. As more and more regulations keep piling on, it's just much more economical to be ahead of this. And if you have safer chemicals in your products, you don't have to worry about the next piece of legislation that comes out of Europe that's going to affect your global supply chain. So there's a lot of interest in how to move to safer chemistry, which I'm really heartened to see. But it's only one small part of that sustainability goal that we all have to work towards.
So if so many companies are voluntarily getting on board the sustainability drive because it makes long-term business sense and lots of these people actually care about the planet and their grandchildren, do we need more regulation or can we just rely on this voluntary action alone?
We certainly are not seeing this become the norm. There's a lot of resistance to moving forward. Because basically, I think a lot of people think chemistry is just a very complicated thing. They don't have to worry about it. They couldn't understand it anyway. They'll leave it to the chemical industry to give them what works. There's no regulations forcing them. So, you know, we really are at sort of at the beginning of this road to greener chemistry. And we need a lot more incentives to push all companies to move forward. I guess my question is, why is it up to the consumer to feel responsible for this? And that's why I'm saying it's not an easy answer. We have access to companies. We see progress being made. We try to spread best practice. We work with a lot of the pollution prevention folks in government level. You're seeing a lot of cities, for instance, now passing bylaws and resolutions to phase out hazardous plastics. But the consumer really is at a disadvantage.
I think so, too. I feel that way when I go to the store, where I'm at a disadvantage partly because these products aren't labeled. These, you know, my children's toys don't say contains cancer-causing ingredients. So there's a lack of transparency. There's a lack of options. And I feel like it's so easy for me as an individual to get stuck on trying to learn how to navigate this toxic landmine. It's like trying to choose from the least toxic thing on this menu. And I keep wanting to bring it back and say, Our real power is not in choosing from this list of toxic things on a menu, but our real power is determining what gets on that menu. And products that we bring into our home and our schools and workplaces just should not be toxic. There should not be toxic products on that menu. And for that, I don't see any solution other than stronger regulation at the national and international level.
We saw a big change in Europe a few years ago where a lot of the European states had been pushing very progressive chemicals. You know, you had Denmark saying, we have to move forward on – Denmark and Sweden, we have to move forward on PVC phase-outs and we have to get rid of, you know, hormone-disrupting chemicals. And you saw all this movement, which, by the way, is also happening at state level here in the U.S. And the European Union decided to – confront the reality that we really didn't know that much about the chemicals that were in the economy, because prior to about the mid 1970s, any chemical industry could produce any chemical, put it on the market into any product, and they never had to check what impact it had on human health or the environment.
That is just incredible.
I know. When I tell people that, people look aghast. You know, it's like, well, you could actually produce anything and put it out without ever doing any kind of safety testing on it.
So, I think there is an assumption that people have that if something is on the shelf in the supermarket, it's safe. Somebody has tested it and it's safe. So are you saying that we can't make that assumption?
Absolutely. You cannot make that assumption. You cannot assume that everything sitting on a shelf in whatever retail you're going into has been thoroughly tested, completely known about, and has been given this stamp of approval.
What organizations exist, especially in the United States or internationally, for just concerned citizens who want to get involved in cleaning up our products and getting rid of these toxic chemicals?
I always say look on, try to understand who's working on these issues, either in your community or in your state. The U.S. has a very rich network of groups working on chemicals and safe products. You can find where these groups exist by going to something called safemarkets.org. This is a new website that acts as a portal to give any member of the public information about where all these groups are working, the market campaigns.
I've never heard of that.
It will bring you to a whole other series of other websites, which is because we realized in the Green Chemistry, Safer Chemicals movement that we needed to make this information more accessible. So we've now developed this sort of portal websites that will give people easy access to find all these state-based groups that are working on these issues.
Chemistry is not going to happen overnight. By some estimates, there are 100,000 chemicals in use just in the United States. Only 300 of them have been tested for safety, and only a handful have ever been banned or restricted. That's because the main U.S. law regulating chemicals, passed 37 years ago, doesn't require chemicals to be proven safe before use. Chemicals are considered innocent until proven guilty. Now, that's a great principle if you've been accused of a crime, but it makes no sense if we want to protect health and the environment. And the way the law is written and enforced, it's almost impossible to remove a chemical from the marketplace. The American Chemistry Council, the powerful lobbying group of the chemical industry, works hard to keep it that way, defeating or watering down every attempt at reform. As Bev and I discussed, the European Union is making a fundamental shift in its laws, requiring that new chemicals and products be tested and proven safe. The U.S. is getting left behind, and it's our families and communities who are at risk because of it. Dozens of organizations have been working with allies in Congress to strengthen our antiquated chemical laws. But environmental and public health groups can't go up against the political clout of the chemicals industry alone. They need the support of us, the majority of Americans who believe that public health should come before chemical industry profits. Elected officials need to hear from us loudly and repeatedly until they get the message. On our website, storyofstuff.org, is a link where you can find the contact information for your representatives in Washington, D.C. Tell them it's time to fix our broken system of chemical regulation. Protecting our health must be the priority. That's it for this episode of The Good Stuff. Our show comes to you from the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland, California. Our engineer is James Rowland. Post-production by Brandon McFarlane. The Good Stuff is produced by Bill Walker. We'll have another show online in a few weeks. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. Find us on Facebook and storyofstuff.org and keep working on the good stuff in your own community. Thanks for being part of the solution. We'll see you.